supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. We got another of those jam-packed shows for you today, cats and kittens. When we get to the question of the week, it'll be a topic we have never covered before, which is gardening for the blind. And we're not going to tell you how we do it. We're going to tell you about how some people who can't see still enjoy their gardens. We're also going to tell you how some plantings around the chicken houses on the Eastern Shore may be something you want to imitate in your own garden. It's a lot to get done, so let's hop right to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Gurjeet, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you doing, Mike?
I am just ducky today, thank you. Am I getting your name correct?
Yes, perfect. I'm in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania.
Oh, just outside of Philadelphia and home of the famed Tower Theater, where I used to see a
yes.
lot of rock and roll back in the 70s.
I wasn't around back then.
Thanks. I needed that, girl. all right. What can we do for you?
So my mom planted this fig tree like 4 or 5 years ago, I want to say. It's about 12 feet tall now, maybe 11. But this winter it was really cold, and it seems that part of it has like dried out. When mm-hmm. I take a piece of the branch from the dried side, it just snaps and it's completely white on the inside. There's no leaves on one whole side of this tree.
Right, that would be common because you didn't protect it over the winter.
Well, we had been for the past several years, but since last year we got fruit, and I thought it was big enough. We didn't cover it this year.
And you learned, right? You learned.
Yeah.
You learned the only way gardeners learn, which is death and despair. That teaches us so much about our plants.
Is there anything I can do to salvage part of the tree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's going to be fine long term. So we're into the growing season now. You should be seeing a lot of good new growth on the living part of the tree.
Yes, I see figs and leaves.
Oh, okay. Well, you got to get the dead wood off there as quick as you can.
Okay.
So just go out there with a pair of pruners or loppers, depending on the size of the branches we're talking about. And did you say like half of the tree is dead?
I would say like 2/3 of it is dead.
And that's the part that's facing out. I'm presuming it's planted near a house.
Yeah.
And it's the exposed part that got killed.
Yeah, actually it is. It's the part where the sun rises.
Yeah, well, it's not so much that. It's away from the protection of the wall of the house. That's key.
Oh, okay.
Your house saved the back third.
I mean, it is in the middle of the yard, though. It's not like up against a wall.
Oh, okay. All right. So here's what we're going to do. What I want you to do on the next nice day is take off about half of the dead stuff.
Okay.
Then give the tree some time to recover. And but not too long, like a week, maybe 10 days, then go out and prune off the rest of the dead stuff. Believe it or not, this is actually going to help the living part of the tree to get rid of the dead material. And then at the end of the season, what did you do in previous years to protect it?
My mom would just cover it with like a plastic something or yeah, nothing crazy. When it was little, she would cover it with a plastic container.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she would put a bucket over top of it.
Yeah.
So it looked like a fig with a funny hat.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, what I want you to do at the end of this season is drive some stakes into the ground mm-hmm. about a foot away from the tree and then wrap burlap around the stakes. Don't wrap the tree. Don't use any kind of plastic. If you want to put a silly hat on it again, you can. That's fine. But the burlap will cut the wind and keep frost from settling on the fig. When we get to spring again and you start to see new growth in your other plants, take that burlap away. Again, the burlap should not be leaning against the fig or touching it. Really, you're just creating a kind of a little living room around it. And then watch for the new growth of the fig. And there's always going to be some winter kill. So then you get out there with the pruners and you cut off the parts of the fig that don't look good, that are dead. And if you do that, since you say you have figs forming already, this may be a tree that gives you two crops a year. You might be able to get two runs of figs out of this puppy if you give it some good winter protection now that it's good sized.
Yes, they will. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, my pleasure. You take care.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing? I appreciate you taking my call.
I appreciate you making it, John. Where are you, man?
I'm calling from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm in the University City section in West Philly.
Okay, whereabouts? I know University City real well. I used to live at 49th and Chester when I was in college.
Okay, I'm in a 47th and Cedar.
Okay, yeah.
A couple blocks away from there.
All right, what can we do for you, man?
I'm calling about my rose bush. I'm a novice gardener, and I started planting some perennials last year. And I did the taboo thing you always say not to do, which I learned last year, was not to use that fertilizer, which I did. And a lot of my plants cooked from the outside in on the roots and just died. But my little rose bush made it through last year and made it through the winter. But this year, I've noticed after the spring, as the spring got started getting warmer, that my branches were very thin and wiry. And all the leaves have fallen off it. I have hardly any leaves on it at all. And I have a couple new sprouts coming up through the center with some red leaves on it. But the ones that have some buds on the very tip of the end of it, there are no leaves below that.
Yeah, that is very unusual. Does the rose get a good amount of sun?
Yes, a lot of sun.
Okay, good. And you said you used chemical fertilizer to kill your plants last year.
Yes.
Have you done anything to them this year?
No, nothing.
And you say you have branches that are leafless, but they have buds on them.
Yes, the buds are at the very tip of the branch.
And do the buds look, for lack of another word, lush? Do they look like they're going to open up into flowers?
Yes, they have opened up. Yes.
Oh, okay.
I've gotten about a half dozen so far this year, but I didn't know where to cut them. My aunt always told me when you cut them, you always cut above the first fifth leaf. And I couldn't do that this year because there are no leaves there.
Right. Okay, so here's the deal. Here's what you're going to do this year. Do you have any mulch on the ground?
I did put mulch in it last year, but I was listening to you this weekend, and I removed the mulch, so there's nothing on there right now.
Okay, so you had crappy wood mulch.
Yes.
Okay. Go out and get a bag of good, high-quality compost. Find your closest independent garden center and buy a good bag of compost. Not composted manure. You want yard waste compost. It may not say that. There's also a great compost out there that's generally available in the Philadelphia area at retail from a company called Coast of Maine, and that's lobster compost. Believe it or not, they compost the lobster waste from fisheries, and there are elements in seafood shells like lobster that are amazing for plants, specifically roses. One of the main naturally occurring things is called chitin. And it only occurs really in the shells of the sea creatures. But it's dynamite for plants. It helps protect them against disease and against stress, and it provides a nice natural feeding.
Do you just lay that on the top of the surface?
Correct. 2-inch mulch around the rose, not touching the stem, but going out as far as the furthest branch goes. And then, you know, it sounds like it's a pretty small plant, so just put the bag in a cool, dry spot and continue to use it. It won't go bad.
Okay. Is this plant diseased, or are there some bugs eating these leaves?
No, you tried to kill it. You told us that.
Is that what it was? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I gotcha.
And it refused to die. So as the roses bloom, after each rose starts to fade, get out there with a pair of pruners and just cut off where the rose is.
Okay.
If you have any brown or really woody parts of the plant that don't have any leaves or buds on them, prune those off as well.
Okay.
It may seem like you're taking off almost all the plant, but roses can take a pretty hard pruning. The thing is, you want to stop pruning by, like, say, mid-July, late July, nothing after August 1st.
Okay.
But even after August 1st, I still want you to pull off the finished flowers. And then next year, you should have some really good results, and the plant should look normal.
Great, Mike.
All right, man?
All right, thank you very much for your help, Mike. I appreciate you answering my phone call.
My pleasure. Take care. Thank
you,
sir.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will host Quizzo at the PHS Pop-Up Garden at 15th and South Streets at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, June 19th. And I'll deliver lunchtime lectures at the famed Chautauqua Institute in upstate New York on Monday, July 30th and Tuesday, July 31st. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with plants that protect the earth from chickens and gardening for people with little to no sight. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And Smart Pots, makers of the Smart Pot and the Big Bag Bed, fabric containers for your performance container garden. Learn more about the features and benefits of the Smart Pot at smartpots.com. That's smartpots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what do you think of when you think of gardening for people with little to no sight? Do you think of fragrance and texture? Well, we're going to tell you about a couple of people who are down there in the trenches growing tomatoes and sweet corn that they can't see, but they sure can taste. We'll tell you how to do it, and we'll take more of your fabulous phone calls. But first, an interview about plantings around chicken houses that may help you with some ideas about your garden. Mr. Jim Passwaters, Vegetative Environmental Buffer Coordinator for the Delmarva Poultry Industry. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Glad to see you, or hear you.
Yeah. First, I'll give a little bit of personal background. I have been driving Route 13 up and down for most of my adult life. I have family in the Virginia Beach area, and I am well acquainted with every mile of the Eastern Shore. And there are portions of the Eastern Shore that almost look like they're one gigantic chicken farm. There is a lot of poultry in the Delmarva area.
There certainly is.
Are you number one in chickens around the country or the world or anything like that?
Sussex County, Delaware is number one. I'm not sure exactly where the whole Delmarva stands.
Well, let's put it this way. How many chickens you got?
A lot.
Yeah, I can
go. About 600 million.
About 600 million chickens in production at any one given time.
A year. No, in a year.
In a year. 600 million yes. A year. There is a program that has been created by the industry itself to use vegetation to ease the effects of having that many birds pooping in such a small space. When did this program go into effect, and what is it comprised of?
Well, originally, I own a landscaping business. And we were asked to plant trees around chicken farms back in 2001. I've lived on Delmarva my entire life and been quite aware of all the chicken farms around here. They changed technologies about the year 2000, 2001. It used to be open ventilation chicken houses where they would drop the side curtains down. The technology advanced, and they've changed over to what they call tunnel fans. There's fans on the ends of the houses that actually circulate the air out. Well, the fans cause a little bit of noise, create a little bit of dust. The thought process was that they probably wouldn't make the neighbors really happy. Sussex County, Delaware, was one of the fastest growing counties on the East Coast a few years back. We have a lot of people moving in that aren't real familiar with farming practices. They don't like the sounds, the smells, the looks, and so forth. So with a little foresight, the University of Delaware did some plantings, experimental plantings, putting trees and shrubs around poultry farms, basically to hide the farm so that people moving in the area that weren't familiar with the process wouldn't get so alarmed. The Delmarva poultry industry saw the advantage to this and started a program called the Vegetative Environmental Buffers Program in 2006. My landscape company has planted more of these buffers around chicken farms than any company in the world. They came to me and asked me if I would be interested in working for Delmarva Poultry Industry, and I accepted the position and have been here since 2007.
Now, this technique sounds like the old hedgerows that used to be essential for farming practices at the turn of the century and into the 30s.
It's basically the same thing, except they're closer to the poultry houses. Our experiments have revealed that they need to be, you know, approximately about 50 feet from the chicken houses to help block the winds and help capture dusts and so forth. But it's a very similar practice.
And, of course, when I'd be driving up and down Route 13, it would generally be in the summertime. I'm no fool. I'm going down to Virginia Beach in August and September when the water's like a hot tub. So,
gotta fight the traffic, though.
Yeah, and you can see those chicken houses sitting out in the sun, and I feel bad for the birds. Would it be impractical to grow shade trees even closer to the houses, and maybe those fans wouldn't have to work so hard?
We're actually doing some of that now. The program started back in 2001. Probably the majority of the trees have only been in maybe 7 to 8 years. They're planted kind of small, so as they're starting to grow up, we're starting to see the effects of that. And basically, we're starting to see real good success in the winter months where it's saving energy because the cold wind blows really hard against those poultry farms. That blocks that cold wind and saves a tremendous amount of gas consumption on keeping the houses warm.
And that was one of the prime reasons that hedgerows came into existence, was to block that wind.
Exactly. And it's very effective.
There's a lot of nutrients in that chicken house. Are those nutrients being used to deliberately feed the plants, or are the plants just taking up the excess that might otherwise get into that water table that is very high in your area?
The plants are just taking up any excess. And in most instances, if a farm is kept clean, there's not much spillage of the manure and so forth. But the manure is used for cash crops like grain, corn, soybeans, and so forth.
Yeah, because properly processed, composted chicken manure is great for growing non-fruiting plants like sweet corn.
Yes, it's an organic fertilizer.
Although your birds are not, right, the majority? Or do you have any organic farms? Do you have any?
Yes, Purdue recently bought out Coleman Farms, and they're growing strictly organic.
Oh, that's great. Do any of your farms incorporate outside areas?
Yes, all of the organic farms have pastures.
I guess having the more plants outside would both be protective for the chickens and give them a great life experience, so to speak, because they love pecking around the bottom of plants.
Right. We're recently just experimenting now with planting shade plants in the pastures. They have artificial shade at the moment, but we're putting in plants that will provide actual shade, natural shade for the birds.
Do you have water for them outside as well?
Yes.
One of the interesting things that a lot of people don't realize about the organic standard is they think all it means is no pesticides were used in the raising of the crops or the livestock. But that's not true. A huge part of becoming organically certified is having a vibrant farm, is having lots of diverse plants and improving the soil structure as you grow or produce organically. And it sounds like your vegetative buffers are a great thing for somebody who even wants to go organic. They've got all this diversity outside.
That's correct. We've recently planted one organic farm with peach trees. We've planted some blackberries on some of the farms, a lot of different specimens that we're trying out to see which works the best.
So do you see this expanding, our growers in other states? Because this would be great for any kind of high density farming, so to speak, livestock raising. This would be great around cattle pens and horse farms. Right. And
we're probably the only chicken trade industry that has a plant person on full-time staff. I have been consulting with people in Australia, people in University of Arkansas, Denmark, Missouri, North Carolina, Shenandoah Valley. You know, we were trendsetters, and other people are calling and asking, you know, how we're doing it, how's it working out, how do we do this. I've even looked on Google Maps and designed some buffers for some folks in different areas of the country because they've read about what we have done. And the same issues are happening in other parts of the country where people are moving into rural areas and that aren't used to the agricultural practices and then start complaining a little bit. We're always trying new things. One of the new things that we're working on right now is pollinators. Pollinators are a big deal for helping fruits and vegetables and just native wildflowers and our native bees. The native bees and monarchs and so forth are becoming less and less. So I looked around on poultry farms and I found that there's a lot of extra space there that traditionally is planted in turf grass. It has to be mowed once a week. So these are areas that we figured that we can plant pollinator plots in that will help the environment, help the bees, help butterflies, plus eliminate some of the mowing, which uses up a lot of fuel and produces carbon into the atmosphere and so forth on some of these poultry farms.
That's great. What kind of plants are we talking about?
We're talking about milkweeds, asters, all kinds of wildflowers, butterfly weed, everything that will attract pollinators. We grow hundreds of different types in our nursery at home, and we're planting a lot of these things by seed.
You mentioned earlier on the University of Delaware was responsible for helping you out early on. I can't tell you how many times their name comes up in conversations. Delaware is a small state, but the U of D always seems to me to be punching above their weight.
They certainly do. The person that was involved, his name is Bud Malone, is retired now, but he had the foresight to see that with the increase in population, the new technologies being used, larger poultry houses and so forth, that this could potentially become a problem with neighbor relations, and had the foresight to see it back in the year 2000 and start some experimental programs, and it's been very effective.
And it has to be great for the water quality.
Yes, it is. We estimate that we've planted over 40,000 trees, shrubs, and grasses on poultry farms. And young trees, especially, and grasses absorb up a lot of nutrients, help filter out the water. It's been great.
That's amazing. Where can people get more information, Jim?
DPIchicken.org.
DPI Chicken for Delmarva Poultry Industry.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. We've been speaking with Jim Passwaters, the Vegetative Environmental Buffer Coordinator at Delmarva Poultry Industry. For more information on these vegetative buffers, which have great use for even a small-scale gardener, but especially for any size farm, that's dpichicken.org. Thanks, Jim, for being on the show today.
Thank you very much.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kathleen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am just ducky today, Kathleen. Thank you for asking. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
And where is Kathleen fine?
Guilford, Connecticut. It's about 12 miles east of New Haven along the shore.
Oh.
Long Island Sound.
Tough gardening conditions, though. What can we do for you?
Well, we have a little cottage actually on Long Island Sound on the back of a bay, and my question is about tomatoes. We have a garden, and last year our tomatoes got what I think, I hope you can identify, it might be early blight, and by the end of the season we didn't get a lot of fruit. And people told me I can't plant tomatoes there because the fungus spores will affect these tomatoes and potatoes. So my questions are, what do I have? What can I do to get rid of it, and what can I plant there while I'm trying to get rid of it?
Yeah, let's not assume that you have anything, because the three things you said are things that do happen, but they're not connected. Tell me what the symptoms were of your tomato plants.
They were first growing very well, and then some of the leaves, I think more near the bottom of the plant, but I'm not 100% sure, got spots on them and turned yellow, and then those leaves would start to fall off. And then the green tomatoes, they would stop growing and fall off or just sort of stun the growth. And then the plant would die and the tomatoes might still be hanging there, but the leaves had all died.
I was hopeful when you said it started with the yellowing of the bottom leaves, because that in your region would be verticillium wilt, which is a very common problem when you plant tomatoes in the same spot in the garden year after year. And the answer is easy. You just rotate to different spots. But speaking of spots, were there spots on the tomatoes?
No, on the leaves.
Okay. Then it's not a blight. which is good. There are other conditions, leaf spot, septoria, that cause spotting of the leaves, but it really doesn't have anything to do. There is no overwintering fungus, let's put it that way, especially in your region where the winters are pretty long and cold. Now, have you been growing tomatoes in the same spots in this garden for several years?
Maybe 3 years.
Yeah, your problem is easy to diagnose. It is the most common tomato problem. It's not truly a disease, and it's really easy to defeat. The first year you put a tomato in the ground, let's call it spot A, that tomato will grow naturally. Everything will be cool. Down in the soil, an organism called verticillium is attracted to...
Verticillium?
Yeah, you don't need to know that.
Okay.
You don't need to know that. Yeah, it's okay. It's not sorcery. Knowing the names of your enemies does not defeat them. So it's the problem that's caused by growing tomatoes in the same spot year after year. That's all you have to remember. And there's no fungus involved. So the second year you grow tomatoes in that exact same spot, the verticillium starts to breed more. There's more of it in the soil. It's tremendously attracted to the roots of your tomato plant. So by year three, the wilt, verticillium wilt, has built up so much that it takes over and it interferes with the plant's ability to take nutrients and water out of the soil. The leaves start turning yellow on the bottom. The yellowing progresses up the plant.
Mm-hmm.
This will not occur if you move your tomatoes to an area where tomatoes did not grow in the previous 2 years. So, you know, and do you grow potatoes in your garden?
I did grow potatoes last year in a separate container in the side of the garden, just an old, like an old copper pot that
had,
or tin pot, and
sure.
They were amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the connection with potatoes and late blight is if you have diseased potatoes you leave in the soil, but that's a false trail. There's nothing going on there. Now, how do you grow your tomatoes? How do you feed them? How do you support them?
We try to do all organic. We have cages for them, the big heavy wire cages.
Good.
And we feed them compost and organic. I think I gave them some fish food, different things.
That sounds good. When it comes to fertilizers, I would be careful about a fertilizer that was fish only. The oldest one that's been around forever has a lot of chloride in it, chlorine.
Okay.
So much so that it has to state it on the label. Fish and seaweed mixes, however, are astoundingly good for your plants, and I recommend them. So make sure they have good support. Make sure there's good airflow between the plants. When you water, do not water from overhead. Don't wet the leaves of your plants deliberately. If you have to add water, and last year I'm guessing you didn't have to water your garden. You had plenty.
Yes. We watered a lot because we're right on the, we have a lot of wind, so it's very drying. So we did water quite a bit.
Okay, hold back on the watering this year. Plants need to dry out. You're at a high water table. So if you need to water, you should only water deeply once a week, you know, and that's only if we don't get rain. But then let the plant roots dry out in between and don't wet the leaves. That's what causes the spots on the leaves.
Okay.
But I think you'll be good as long as you can move those plants to a different spot.
Okay. Thank you very much. This has been very helpful, and I enjoy your show.
Well, thank you very much, Kath. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will deliver lunchtime lectures at the famed Chautauqua Institute in upstate New York on Monday, July 30th and Tuesday, July 31st. I will speak at the American Birding Expo in Oaks, PA on Saturday, September 22nd, and I'll play a round or two of gardening in beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina on Tuesday, October 23rd. But don't go checking the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to grow unseen tomatoes and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Smart Pots, makers of the Smart Pot and the Big Bag Bed, fabric containers for your performance container garden. Learn more about the features and benefits of the Smart Pot at smartpots.com. That's smartpots.com. And the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to a fascinating topic, gardening for those with little to no sight. If you're thinking fragrant plants that are easy to reach, you're thinking small. Some of these people are growing sweet corn, tomatoes, and they're having as much fun in the garden as you are. We'll tell you how they do it after a couple more of your fun phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Michelle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Michelle. Where are you?
I'm right now in Belbrook, Ohio, a suburb of Dayton, getting ready to move to a house that's being built in Fairborn, Ohio, about 20 miles from here.
Okay, so you're in Ohio. What can we do for Michelle in, is that that's the Buckeye State, right?
That's right. Newly transplanted here from the Phoenix, Arizona area. When I lived in Phoenix, I was growing citrus trees in my backyard, oranges and lemons and limes. And I know they won't grow here, but I'm just wondering what kind of fruit trees can I grow here?
So we're basically talking about the two different kinds of fruits. You left an area where you can grow fruits outdoors that can't tolerate any kind of freezing cold temperatures. And, of course, that's all the citrus fruits. But the other fruits, apples, peaches, raspberries, plums, pears, blueberries, all of these tree fruits and small fruits and cane fruits actually require what's called a chilling period and can't be grown in the Phoenix area. So of the ones I just mentioned, which ones would appeal to you? And I'll tell you which are difficult and which are easy.
Probably apples and pears.
Apple trees are a little bit difficult to grow east of the Rockies. They require yearly pruning. They require thinning of the fruits, and the apples will be attacked by insects. But all of that is doable. They are not, however, a low-care fruit. Pears, on the other hand, are very easy to grow, require very little pruning, are not attractive to a lot of different pests, and are probably the easiest large tree fruit to grow. So the pears, I mean, you could go pear crazy.
What variety of pears would be best?
See, now you're talking about your local conditions, and you're also, to some degree, not as much as with apples, but now you're talking about, do you want fresh eating? Do you want stuff you're going to make cobblers out of and things like that? So you want to contact your local extension office and get a list of the varieties that are recommended for your area, or conversely, find the local garden center where you're going to buy your supplies and where you're going to be a regular and see what they have to offer. Now, at this time of year, I'll tell you, you're in the catbird seat because it's too late now to plant a tree and get anything off of it. But if you wait till the end of the season, say mid to late August, where you are in Ohio, let the nursery know that you're very interested in getting a couple or couple three pear trees off them. And in the fall, late summer, early fall, typically nurseries will be selling those trees at a third or half off because they don't want to have to overwinter them. And the trees will be a year older. Also, there's a much better survival rate for trees that are planted in the fall than even in the spring. The survival rate planted in the summer is very low because the trees just can't get over the transplant shock and the heat. So research your varieties. Think about the ones that you want. And especially if you're going to mostly be taking care of these things yourself, you want either dwarf or semi-dwarf varieties that stay fairly small and compact. You don't want a 30-foot high tree. And then,
no, I don't.
But this gives you plenty of time to find the part of your new property that will have the highest ground, which is where you want to plant fruit trees, and full sun all around and good airflow. So you can actually plan this, put these puppies in the ground in September. You're going to have great harvests after that.
That's great. Thank you. And what about the berries that you mentioned?
Raspberries proliferate. You put some canes in the ground in the spring and they spread like mad, and they'll give you two or three crops a year, depending on the variety. But they will spread. They need room for the canes to spread around. They'll come up in new locations every year. Blueberries are more stable. They are shrubs. They are bushes. They require, however, a highly acidic soil. So when they're planted, you need to refill the hole with peat moss. But other than that, they don't spread. They just get bigger. And both are incredibly easy to grow in Ohio.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
All right. It's my pleasure. And if you want a little bit of that citrus memory, you can buy indoor plants that you can take out during the summer that are specially designed to stay small, and you'll get really decent edible fruits off of them.
Okay, I'll look into that too. Thank you.
All right, good luck, Michelle. Mark, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Mark. How are you, man?
Doing all right. We are in Philadelphia.
Where in Philadelphia are you?
East Norriton.
That's not really Philly, is it? It's not 191 zip code.
No, it's in Norristown.
Yeah, come on. If you're from Philly, you got to be like from K&A, Bridge and Tarsdale, something like that, you know.
I planted a bur oak tree last fall. Bought it at a nursery. It was about 3 feet tall. And I put it in the ground. And then this spring, it sent out new growth. And the new growth, I would say, it was putting out like 3 or 4 inches of leaves. And then all of a sudden, one day, all of the leaves wilted. And it stopped growing.
When did you plant it specifically? What month last year?
I believe it was probably late October.
When you bought it, was it in a pot? Was it bare root or was it bald and burlapped?
It was potted.
And when you took it out of the pot, did you plant it higher, lower, or the exact soil level?
The exact soil level.
And tell me about the spot it's in. Does it get good sun? Is it up high? Is it down low? Does water pool up?
It does get good sun. We do have a problem with drainage, generally speaking, in our area. I would say that water doesn't pool in that area, but when it does rain, the water does tend to, it doesn't soak into the ground very well, I guess is the best way to put it.
Right. So what else you got growing out there? Is this a lawn or do you have garden beds?
It's in a lawn. Yeah. Last year we had planted some river birch and they did well.
You just answered your own question. River.
You think it's too wet?
Yeah. River birch is one of the few trees that can tolerate a lot of water and wet feet. I also think it is remarkable. If it's not the nicest looking four-season tree, it's right up there on a pedestal with them. They're fabulous trees. I'm surprised they're not utilized more. So maybe you got a guarantee on the oak. Maybe you didn't. If you did, it's time to cash it in because that tree is dead, Jim. And I would replace it with another river birch. You've picked a winner in terms of the other trees, and I would stick with that winter. They are absolutely beautiful with that exfoliating bark, the color. They're very adaptable to tough conditions like you have. You picked a real winter when you put those river birch in. It doesn't sound like the right conditions for a bur oak. And, you know, if you want easy gardening, if you want successful gardening, choose the right plants for the place. And I think in the case of the birches, you absolutely did.
Okay.
All right, man?
All right. Thanks so much.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thank you.
All right. As promised, it is time for a very unusual question of the week. Gardening without sight. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, who will soon fly away to Florida, would you please get us started?
I would be very happy to. And in fact, I think this is such a great topic and one that we haven't covered before. So I think this is really, really wonderful. And I'm excited, even if it is my last question of the week. John in Ocean Pines, Maryland, on the famed Eastern Shore, did not write in, but instead left this phone message. I'd like to hear Mike talk about handicapped gardeners. I went completely blind several years ago, and I'd love a segment on this topic.
Well, John's message really took me back. Took me back to my days as editor of Organic Gardening magazine, when we received a curious tape cassette in the mail in late 92. Just had my name and the magazine's address on a little manila envelope with no postage stamp. Instead, it said, Matter for the Handicapped. I played it while I was stringing the lights on that year's Christmas tree and listened to the NPR-level voice of Joseph Trappa explain how he and his wife Noreen of Idaho Falls gardened without sight.
When I think of gardening for the visually impaired, I think of well-defined pathways leading to plants with interesting textures and scents, like fragrant herbs.
You know, me too. But when I was rereading John's missive, reminds me that the so-called impaired and challenged are often determined to rise higher than common perception. Instead of fragrance and texture, John talked about growing sweet corn and tomatoes in Idaho, which has a very challenging climate.
And you're implying that other people didn't create or tend this garden for him.
No, in fact, his style is the opposite of passive. Here's part of his transcribed message. We'll take turns reading it. Listeners, you might want to close your eyes for this one and open up your imaginations.
John writes, My wife and I are both blind. We love growing tomatoes and sweet corn and are constantly looking for the best varieties for our short season location. We have dabbled in organic gardening, vegetable gardening, not flowers, for many years. And every year the gardens get better, thanks to you and your magazine.
John continues, You're probably wondering how in the world we manage to garden. Well, it's not all that difficult. A blind person or a person with other disabilities can accomplish anything if they just sit down and give proper thought to it.
First, we chose the size of our plot and fenced it in with chicken wire and metal posts. The fence defines the boundaries of the garden. Then I made a wooden pathway smack down the center, and to the left and right of the pathway, I have my rose.
I cut 30-inch-high wooden stakes on my table saw and put one at the end of each row. The stakes have braille plastic markers on them describing what's in that row.
John continues, However, I have a tendency to overplant, and the garden becomes so entangled, especially with tomatoes, that you can hardly walk through it. So we have decided to go to raised bed gardening for everything except our sweet corn. I hope to have 6 raised beds ready this spring. They'll be easier to put a cover over if frost is in the forecast.
Raised beds are also a heck of a lot better for people like us because you always stub your toe on them when you find one, and then you're less likely to walk into your vegetables and crush a beautiful tomato. We can tell when our food is ripe by feel, and I'd say we're right about 80% of the time. When a tomato is genuinely red, you can tell by the tenderness of that tomato. If it's still a little bit firm, give it a day or two and it'll get nice and soft. The same with sweet corn. Pull back the silk, taste the top couple of kernels, and you'll know how much longer it might take. With peppers, squash, and melons, you can tell by the size and the length of time they've been growing.
2 years later, in 1995, the magazine heard from Kate Chamberlain in Walworth, New York, who explained that she went blind at the age of 40 and, quote, sat around feeling unhappy for the next 5 years. Then she pulled herself together and, with the help of her sighted husband, got back into the garden.
Kate wrote, I'm told that my once neglected garden is beautiful again, but I see it in a very different way now. Feeling the difference between soft pine bark, solid boards, and hard brick paths lets me know what section of the garden I'm in. I sit on my son's skateboard and roll along the boards to weed, prune, and harvest. And my fingers have learned to distinguish the firm but not hard flesh of ripe strawberries.
I now realize that my gardening days are far from over. The tall apricot iris reaches up to share its heady fragrance with me, and I rub the tiny leaves of the lemon thyme to marvel in its citrus aroma. It's a very different way of gardening than I was used to, but not impossible. Once a gardener, always a gardener.
Well, that sure was some inspiring information now, wasn't it? Luckily for yous what would like to experience it again and or share it, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week, and you will always find the latest question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Yikes, my producer is threatening to plant poison ivy in my plots if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location when you email us. And or visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org. where you'll find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to ask us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and stay current with the show at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz admirably maintain our website. Alexis Landis, well, what can we say? Alexis has produced You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia and put up with me week after week for about a decade now. But she moves on after today to Florida and a great new job with public broadcasting. Yay for them, boo-hoo for me. It's the end of an era, says our editor, Al Banks. Our associate producer of Production Association, Brett Rader, says, now I know I have a heart because I can feel it breaking. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Yogi Berra once said, it ain't over till it's over, and it sure does get dark early out here. But I'm going to find a flashlight so I can see you again next week.
Long. It's been good to know you so long. It's been good to know you so long. It's been